Welcome to the National Kidney Foundation's Life as a Nephrology Professional podcast, where we explore research and innovation in kidney healthcare. I'm your host, Sam Kent. First of all, I'd like to thank our episode sponsor, Ardelyx, for their support of this important conversation. In today's episode, which is part one of a two-part series, we discuss patient and clinician experiences with hyperphosphatemia. As chronic kidney disease, or CKD, advances, the incidence of hyperphosphatemia increases as a result of several complex and interconnected pathophysiologic processes. We already know chronic hyperphosphatemia in patients with CKD is associated with significant negative clinical consequences, which include vascular calcification, cardiovascular disease, secondary hyperparathyroidism, and left ventricular hypertrophy. Hyperphosphatemia is also recognized as an independent risk factor for chronic kidney disease progression and mortality in non-dialysis-dependent patients. Therefore, we note that current guidelines recommend a multi-pronged approach in the form of reducing dietary phosphate intake and incorporating phosphate-lowering agents to maintain serum phosphate levels towards a normal range. I think achieving target phosphorus levels is a challenge despite best efforts with diet, dialysis, and phosphate binders. Joining us today is our three panelists. They're an esteemed lineup who will be discussing these aspects, and would like to have them introduce themselves now.
Hi, I'm Alex Leidner. I'm a nephrologist and assistant professor of medicine at Northwestern University in Chicago. I completed my residency and fellowship here at Northwestern, as well as a postdoctoral fellowship in artificial intelligence through the Bloom Cardiovascular Institute. I have a special interest in the early detection of kidney disease, as well as working with my mentor, Dr. Tamara Isakova, on impacts of mineral bone disease on cardiovascular health. And thanks for having me here, Sam.
Hello, my name is Anabel Viruete, and I'm a registered dietitian and an assistant professor in the Department of Nutrition Science at Purdue University. I've been a renal nutrition scientist for the last 12 years, and I focus on studying the impact of lifestyle interventions and pharmacological interventions in various clinical outcomes, particularly the gastrointestinal tract. And I also have another line of research focused on health disparities in the Hispanic and Latina population, and I'm really happy to be here.
Hello, everybody. My name is Alex Berrios. I am a kidney patient. I am 44 years old, reside in Louisville, Kentucky, and I am actively on in-center hemodialysis looking to help patients like myself get a clear understanding of having high phosphorus and discuss these barriers that we face. And glad to be here as well. Thanks, Sam.
Well, thank you all for joining us. I'd start with a question with Alex. Why do we target hyperphosphatemia? I know I have discussed it briefly in our introduction, but you know, getting a clinician's perspective is very important here.
Yeah, so I think, you know, in addition to all the cardiovascular risk and vascular calcification that you brought up earlier in the introduction, you know, I think there's, you know, patient-centered effects, like particularly itching can really negatively impact a patient's lives. And even indirectly, we're finding more associations with elevated phosphorus, like fibroblast growth factor or FGF23, can have a similar compounding effect on cardiac and patient health. Elevated phosphorus also, you know, can contribute to secondary hyperparathyroidism, adversely affecting bone health, creating fractures and pain for our patients. But I think actually most notably, the reason why phosphorus as a big treatment target exists in our specialty is, you know, research done by Dr. Block in the late 90s, where they very kind of robustly showed that dialysis patients with higher serum phosphorus levels have significantly worse morbidity and mortality. And the signal's sort of so strong that despite everything, you know, we do to, you know, try to, you know, optimize the exact level of phosphorus in the treatment, which I, you know, hope we'll discuss later, we know we need to do something about it.
I know there's a lot of focus on what is the recommended, you know, phosphorus level that we should be focusing on and frequency of draws. You know, there's also this thought process around whether they should be an ideal versus recommended versus practical. What are your thoughts on that?
I wish for this answer I could just say, you know, it should be less than 5.5, check it once a month, move on. But I think there's a lot of nuance, a lot of, you know, patient-centered care, you know, co-discussion, co-decision-making when it comes to phosphorus levels. And the background to that is really that you got to understand a couple things. One, measuring phosphorus in the same patient can have sort of significant variation. So any treatment should really be based upon a trend. You know, luckily with our dialysis patients with whom phosphorus is usually elevated or, you know, becomes the most important with, we do have a lot of labs to get. And we also have other markers of elevated phosphorus, like somebody's PTH, FGF23, their vitamin D, other parts of the mineral bone axis that might, you know, let us know that somebody's phosphorus is really elevated as opposed to just shifted out from the liver or bone or based on their current insulin level. But, you know, while we do know a high phosphorus is associated with bad outcomes, like I just mentioned, the nephrology community has a hard time proving with randomized control trials that lowering phosphorus improves outcomes. There could be a lot of reasons for this. Phosphorus deposition, you know, in arteries causing calcific diseases and coronary disease is a longstanding process that maybe predates the elevated phosphorus level and looks more back towards elevated PTH and FGF23 levels. Dialysis patients have significant comorbidities, so proving any one thing is beneficial gets very hard. Or we just might have lack of effective treatments. Phosphorus binders, especially like calcium binders and aluminum binders, have some significant side effects, and so they might, you know, replace one harm with another. So we can have kind of a hard time proving that just, you know, making somebody's phosphorus go from 9 to 8 to 7 is also reversing that mortality that I, you know, mentioned in that large trial. Currently, the largest study targeting outcomes in phosphorus level is ongoing in Canada. They've recruited a lot of patients. They are using mostly calcium-based binders, but, you know, we await the results and are hopeful we can sort of get a little more guidance on what we're doing with phosphorus. Based on KDIGO guidelines, we do have goals here, and the goal tends to be expert opinion, and that's to treat towards a normal phosphorus. So if somebody's phosphorus is 8, get it towards normal, which, again, the upper limit of normal on most labs is about 4.5 milligrams per deciliter. But most places, you know, specifically the USRDS and many of the dialysis companies here follow a level of 5.5. So getting towards that level of 5.5 is what we all sort of strive for. And in doing that, we also don't want to overshoot it and cause somebody to have hypophosphatemia, because there's effects of that too, as, you know, respiratory depression, cardiac dysfunction and arrhythmia, lower extremity edema, weakness. And so we have to watch our people's phosphorus closely to make sure that we don't cause, you know, excess harm from any treatments for lowering phosphorus. To that end, how often do you check phosphorus? I think checking phosphorus once a month, as many of the dialysis units do, is probably sufficient. You know, we don't need to harp over it every single day and cause anybody anxiety about their phosphorus level from 1 minute to the next. But also knowing that it's a total body store of phosphorus, which is primarily an intracellular molecule, we have to give people time to equilibrate, implement dietary changes, get used to changes in medication regimens, and have their phosphorus equilibrate before making another change. And I think once a month is appropriate for this. To kind of tie this together with the first question, you know, why manage hyperphosphatemia and to what goal? You know, I just said that there's no real, you know, hard and fast randomized goal that says that getting somebody's phosphorus lower. So why do we do it? You know, based off of expert opinion in the field and just as doctors, dialysis and sort of transplant patients spend an extraordinary amount of time and effort, you know, furthering their health and longevity with coming to dialysis, taking their medications regularly. And even without the best randomized data, hopefully managing phosphorus is one that, you know, we all accept is physiologically plausible to, you know, result in better outcomes for cardiovascular health and disease. And we want to provide people support and work with people through co-management to give them exactly as much support as they want or need. And a lot of people want to optimize their health, and we might need to work out the fine details as what exactly is optimum. But again, we work with them to, again, get this value more normal to them to hopefully help them live a more normal life and feel better.
So, you know, you touched upon phosphorus management being almost a quality metric per se. And, you know, various databases and registries have actually looked at how well we're doing with hyperphosphatemia. But, you know, having an overall longitudinal view as a clinician, how well is hyperphosphatemia really being managed?
So, you know, I don't want to say how well is it doing, because, again, we don't really know what we're doing, whether it's well or not for patients. We know we think it's good. But, you know, it doesn't surprise me that actually, you know, pooled data from the USRDS from 2013 to 2019 shows 40% of hemodialysis patients and 45% of patients on peritoneal dialysis have a phosphorus above 5.5. Again, it's not surprising because a big part of phosphorus is diet, and that's such an ingrained habit that by the time you're old and you've learned what you eat, it's a really difficult habit to break. And I think that's probably why it's great that we have such a multidisciplinary sort of discussion going on here, because it's not just get your phosphorus lower. It's, you know, how do we make the lifestyle changes, the medication changes, and the, you know, clinical changes to do that and support people who are trying to do that.
You know, I recognize that dietitians are indispensable in this whole process. So I'll turn to Annabelle and ask, what strategies have you actually found helpful for discussing hyperphosphatemia with patients on dialysis?
Yeah, so limiting the amount of phosphorus a patient eats is probably the number one thing that a renal dietitian focuses when talking with patients. And it can certainly be a point of stress because the recommendations early on were very restrictive towards a variety of foods, really. Everything that had phosphorus, it was basically restricted. But luckily, some research in the last few years, well, not few, 10 to 15 years probably, has been shown that what the food source really matters. And more recently, for example, there's been a big push on educating patients on limiting foods that contain phosphate-containing additives. And these are commonly used by food manufacturers because they can enhance the flavor, can help with the shelf life, et cetera. But the fact is that these sources of phosphorus may be more easily absorbed. And in fact, there was about 15 years ago, a really nice and clever randomized controlled trial that was published in JAMA, that it was kind of like a very easy approach. They educated patients on how to read food labels and to avoid any ingredient that contained PHOS, just as simple. And they even gave a magnifier to the study participants that were in the intervention groups. And after 3 months, they actually showed that serum phosphorus was lower than the control group that was just receiving the standard of care. So I think in general, educating patients on avoiding these types of foods can be really helpful because these foods that usually contain the phosphate-containing additives also have other types of things that we are trying to avoid, like high content of sodium and also potassium additives. So it's kind of like a win-win-win because you try to limit phosphorus, sodium, and potassium from these highly available sources for absorption. So overall, I think, luckily, the renal nutrition community is moving towards reinforcing positive behaviors rather than being restrictive. And I think that's a good thing for both us and also especially the patients.
And as we talk about patients, you know, I think it's so important to recognize patient-reported outcomes and what patients feel about this. So I'll turn to Mr. Berrios to ask. You know, there are challenges and barriers that, you know, patients on dialysis encounter in trying to achieve this goal phosphorus level that we all talk about. Can you share a little bit about your personal experience in managing hyperphosphatemia?
Yeah, thank you, Sam. I appreciate this. Yeah, my experience with high phosphorus levels is definitely, it's such a challenge. I mean, having to, and something to allude to what the dietitian, what you were saying about restrictive versus a positive environment, my history with phosphorus has not been great. And I know that there's been some struggles at times where it was like, you know, you get that slap on the wrist of every month that during rounding about, hey, your levels are, you know, at 7 or 6, or you're not down at that 5.5. And so, yeah, there was a big struggle. There's always been a struggle there to keep with it and to know that, like, and to learn and to read all your labels on your food and things of that nature. It's something that is just not well versed, I think, for just regular patients. I mean, as a kidney patient and knowing you have to kind of watch for, you know, potassium and sodium and phosphorus, it becomes really daunting. Honestly, it can be very daunting. And then the binders on top of that, the binders are like horse pills. They're really, really big and they're not tasty. It's not something easy to take, like some of the other medications we can just take one twice a day. You have to always have it with you. And so, yeah, it's definitely been a struggle. And looking forward to anything that's out there to make it easier for me and for us as patients.
And you talked about so many issues that you have to deal with in addition to phosphorus. You know, how do you balance this phosphate management with other, you know, health considerations that you have on your mind on a daily basis?
Yeah. So what I do when I'm looking at my meals, I kind of look at what I have for each day, each morning, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and my snacks. And I kind of have to look at, you know, I have to look at the labels of the food, and then I have to kind of monitor it and see, okay, like, if I'm going to have phosphorus, what am I going to have it in the most of, you know, like, I know I'm not going to want like chocolate or a soda or cheese, which are my weaknesses. But I think it's very, you know, I really have to be judicious and really disciplined to look at the labels of what I'm picking out at the grocery store, or if I'm out to eat, or having to sub things all the time, to say, okay, if I know I can't have the cheese on this burger, all right, what am I going to sub it with? Or, you know, if I'm going to have something, you know, a potato or something along those natures. There's phosphorus in everything. And something you alluded to earlier about how there's the more like the natural phosphorus that's in food versus what's kind of processed and what keeps it the shelf life and the flavor. And, you know, you see it in everything. And I think there has to be something said about having true labels about what the phosphorus levels are in certain food. And you don't always see that, not like you do with, like, you know, calories and sodium and sugar and all the things that, you know, on simple things. But I think having a true phosphorus label on food would be great. And I have not seen it personally in my walk arounds and experiences.
Annabelle, you mentioned, you know, reaffirming positive behaviors is such an important aspect of this. Can you give us specific examples of how you do that?
Yeah, so I think that most dietitians probably before have used a lot of like tables with the specific foods to restrict. I think in the past we were really focused about what not to eat, but now we're moving more towards like what to eat and give the patients the tools in order to make small changes, but sustainable changes over time. So I think part of our research too, the research has focused more on like different food sources. So instead of just restricting everything, focus on what the patient is eating, and based on what the patient is eating, doing small changes. So for example, if a patient tends to consume a lot of processed foods or are ready to eat foods, so helping them understand the food label, helping understand what sources of phosphorus can be in those specific foods. So I talked about the PHOS, so teaching them how to read the ingredients and look for those phosphorus containing additives. If a patient is not consuming a lot of these prepackaged foods, so probably that is not going to be the ideal recommendation for that patient. So perhaps focusing more on if they're consuming a lot of more foods at home, trying to focus more on specific culinary techniques in order to limit or reduce the amount of phosphorus. So those things, focusing on what the patient can consume, is probably what would be most beneficial for them and most helpful and less stressful.
Well, thank you, everyone. This concludes the part one of our two-part series. And to the listeners, thank you for tuning into Life as a Nephrology Professional podcast, where we explore best practices and strive to foster a sense of camaraderie among the kidney health community. We really hope that you found this episode educational and informative. I do want to thank our panelists for contributing to today's discussion and invite you to join us for the next episode, the part two of this series, where we'll dive into an in-depth discussion regarding physiology of phosphorus absorption and the new developments in therapeutics. Until next time, may your practice be innovative and your research be groundbreaking. Thank you. Mm-hmm.